Airline Pilot Guy, Episode 11. Hi, I'm Captain Jeff, the host of the Airline Pilot Guy, broadcasting live from Norfolk, Virginia. The Airline Pilot Guy is a show about, aviation news, commentary, travel news, stuff that you might deal with the TSA, and other stuff, all from an airline pilot's perspective. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Airline Pilot Guy. I know it's been a while, again. Things have been quite busy for me. I mentioned in my last show that on the West Coast I had some issues with my parents' health and had to drop a couple trips last week and head out to California to kind of assess things and just make sure everything was okay and put some things in place. And so since I've been back, I got back on Friday, I've been flying a lot, trying to pick up some trips to make up for that time. Incidentally, for those of you who aren't pilots, you may not know this, but we basically are hourly wage earners, and we get paid for doing our flying. If we don't fly a trip, we don't get paid. So in most cases that I know of anyway, airline pilots are not salaried employees. We're hourly wage earners. Now, you can't really compare an hourly wage earner airline pilot to, let's say, a worker, just a regular hourly wage earner, because our hours are tracked differently. So a 40-hour work week might equate to maybe a 15 or 20-hour work week for an airline pilot. Anyway, so I'm here in Norfolk, Virginia. I flew a three-day trip. Was in Columbus, Ohio, El Paso, Texas. Now here in Norfolk, Virginia. And then tomorrow, I think I end up in Gulfport, Mississippi again. Anyway, enough of that. Let's see. Let's play this sound effect right here. Yes, the weather outside was frightful last week. Remember the Hurricane Irene. I don't know if you were affected by that or not. Again, I was out on the West Coast for the most part, so obviously I wasn't affected by that at all. But if you were, let me know. Send in some feedback. Let me know if you were affected by the hurricane as far as your flying schedule is concerned, if you're a pilot, or if you're not a pilot, if you're living up there in the eastern United States, East Coast, let me know if how the Hurricane Irene affected you. I guess for the airline industry, they canceled a whole bunch of flights and kind of disrupted travel for a lot of people. Anyway, and let's see, we also had another Mother Nature event last week.
Fence 3890, do you feel any movement in the ground there? 3374, you feeling any movement in the ground?
Sir, 1448, checking in on the visual one.
It's 1048, join Julie across 33 ground point 7.
Alright, Julie across 33 ground point 7, Citrus 1048.
Stand by. Looks like we're having an earthquake here on the airport. Everything looks fine on the runway, American 1448, clear to land.
Clear to land, American 1448.
That's 3889, Tower.
3889.
Do you feel the ground shaking?
No, we didn't, but we were taxiing. It was kind of bumpy anyway.
Tower 4766.
On tower, say again.
Columbia 4766, our company will no longer let us extend the circle to 33 high every.
Okay, you get the gist. That's the one of the recordings from the DCA, Washington National Tower. Apparently, they felt the earthquake up there in the control tower. And, you know, as many of you know, especially if you live on the West Coast, if you are in some kind of a vehicle and you're rolling along, like driving along in your car, in more cases than not, you're not going to feel the earth moving because you're moving over the earth anyway. But I guess it's true with airplanes as well. Only a couple of people actually felt the earthquake. But I would imagine it's amplified if you're up in a tower. The swaying of the earth, I'm sure, caused a little bit of excitement for the folks in the tower cab up at DCA. Hey, but the good news is they were all awake. Okay, I'd like to start off the show this week with an article that was sent to me by, I believe, Kevin St. John. He sends me a lot of feedback. And this one was quite good, I think. Well, they're all good from you, Kevin. But this one was quite interesting because it kind of illustrates and accentuates what I've been saying for so long about my concern about piloting skills. And this was from MacLean's. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but an article in a magazine. And the writer of this is Chris Sorensen, and this came out August 24th. And he starts off his article talking about Turkish Airlines Flight 1951. Back in February of 2009, they were coming into Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport, and they crashed short of touching down. Let's see, investigators attributed the crash to a faulty radio altimeter, aggravated by pilot errors and oversights. Now, radio altimeters are down-looking, They use radio waves that face down from the airplane. And it depends on the airplane where exactly they're mounted, but somewhere usually in the middle of the airplane. And they point down to the ground, and then, you know, the signals bounce back up, and it gives you a readout of how high you are above the ground at that point. And we used this radio altimeter for our precision approaches so that we know exactly, you know, how many feet we are above the ground. And the autopilot and autoflight systems, especially the coupled landing systems, use the radio altimeter to gather information about the height above touchdown so it knows when to start retarding the throttles for the flare, and when to actually start, you know, pitching the nose up a little bit more to cut the rate of descent so that you have a nice landing. Well, and by the way, these radio altimeters are on for the whole flight, but they only start really registering as far as showing any indication of how high you are above the ground. In most cases, in all the airplanes that I've flown, about 2,500 feet above the ground. Anyway, this airplane, a 737, I don't know what model. I think it was one of the new generation 737s. It was coming into Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. And let's see. The radio altimeter on the captain's side was malfunctioning. And let's see. So while the co-pilot was busy monitoring the autopilot, so everything was hooked up, which used a different altimeter, the captain of the flight was watching the co-pilot as part of a training exercise, and a third safety officer was supposed to be watching everyone to make sure nothing got missed. Well, the autothrust system erroneously engaged its retard mode, thinking it was just above the runway. Okay, they were not. They were, I don't know how far out, maybe half a mile to a mile out. Throttles were retarded, and the plane's nose pitched up. Okay, so the autoflight system thinks that it's just above the runway, and it's starting its retard and flare routine. And it caused the plane to drift into an aerodynamic stall. The flight crew tried to recover by returning the throttles to full power, but their initial efforts were thrwarted by the confused autothrust system, which they forgot to engage. which they forgot to disengage. There was no time for a second try. Okay, so here's the scenario. Co-pilot's flying. Actually, he's flying through the autoflight system or watching the autoflight system. The captain is monitoring that, and then the safety officer is watching all of it, right? And all of a sudden, they're several hundred feet above the ground. The throttles start, you know, retarding to idle. The nose pitches up. Okay, what should be the initial reaction? For me, immediately. Of course, you know, we're not just sitting there with our hands in our laps. We have our right hand for the co-pilot is probably on the yoke, or it should be. His left hand should be on the throttles. And when he starts feeling the throttles retard, immediately I would disconnect the auto throttles, push them back up to where they're supposed to be. And if I feel like the autoflight system is just not doing what it's supposed to do, I disconnect the autopilot and start hand flying the airplane. Or initiate a go around. Either way, you are taking control of the airplane and flying it away from the ground and not crashing. Okay, well, that's not what happened. They were confused, apparently, by what the airplane was doing, and they just kind of watched it crash. Okay, and then, of course, the article goes on to talk about the Air France Flight 447, which we have talked about many, many times on this podcast, and I'm sure we're going to continue talking about it. In fact, I have some feedback regarding that we'll talk about later here in the show today. The McLean's article talks about the flight crew was gripped by confusion. There's a quote here. The first officer that's flying the airplane, "I don't have control of the airplane anymore." And he said, "Now I don't have control of the airplane at all." Okay, as we know from the investigation, it looks like the lack of airspeed for a short period of time caused some confusion. A manual flight was engaged. In other words, the autoflight system and autothrust system just disengaged on its own, and the airplane was being flown manually by the pilot in the right seat, and made some inputs that weren't appropriate for their regime of flight, and ended up getting into a situation, a high altitude aerodynamic stall, which was it was recoverable, but they aggravated the situation and never recovered the airplane. Let's see. The ICATEE, which is the International Committee for Aviation Training in Extended Envelopes, a panel of experts asked by the, another group to look into stalls and other loss of control accidents and find ways to prevent them. Many of these accidents are recoverable. He says they simply shouldn't have happened. In many incidents, the airplane had gone into a stall and every automated safety procedure kicked in, but the pilots failed to recognize the situation and failed to recover. So they're seeing a big trend, especially in the last 5-10 years of big crashes, lots of loss of life and property based on people losing control of the airplane. It used to be the number one cause for losing airplanes was what we call CFIT, or CFIT, controlled flight into terrain. And turns out now that losing control of the airplane is occurring more than controlled flight into terrain. And this is a big problem, and we need to do something about it. And now there are two camps or schools of thought, I should say, out there. There's the school of thought out there, which I think is wrong, that we have a situation where we have autoflight systems more and more that are managing the airplane and flying it efficiently. And when something goes wrong, they think, well, what we need to do is make the autoflight systems even better and, make backup systems that are automatic that will recover the airplane. So in other words, let's throw some more automation at it and see if that, takes care of the problem. Or my school of thought, and the school of thought of a lot of safety experts out there, is that, hey, when the autoflight system starts not working or doing something that it's not supposed to do, hey, let's take control of the airplane and use our pilot skills, if we still have them, and fly the airplane. And so basically that school of thought, that camp is saying, we need more training and we need to emphasize, you know, manual flying skills. You know, I've talked about it before. You know, everybody out there, if you're a pilot listening to this, you should know, you know, what control instruments or what settings, like on your attitude indicator, your power levers, your thrust settings, et cetera, you should set to give you certain performance. You know, if you're climbing out, you should know that, well, in my airplane, about 90 to 93% N1 is going to give you the climb power setting. You know, let's say you're N1 or whatever, one of your other indications is gone. You should know, you know, what the fuel flow should be for a climb and what pitch picture should give you a normal rate of climb. Level flight at 10,000 feet, level flight at 30,000 feet. You should know that in my case, 2.5 degrees, nose high, and a power setting of somewhere around 82% N1 is going to give you level flight. These are just basic things that we have to know. Okay, I know that the advanced autoflight systems that we're using these days kind of lulls you into that sense of complacency, and you never have to worry about it, right? I mean, gosh, those Airbus airplanes were made so that this was something that would never happen. You would never get into an aerodynamic stall because the airplane wouldn't allow you to. But obviously from Air France 447, we're finding out that, guess what? If something happens and the autoflight system just stops working and we take manual control, we need to know some information that apparently was being withheld from the pilots. And also we need to think about, you know, the design of a stall warning system that stops working when it senses that the airspeed information is invalid. You know, in the case of the Air France 447, the stall warning system coming on and then going off and then coming back on, I think is going to be a major finding in this accident for why the crew was so confused about that crash. Anyway, so let's go on with the article here. I'm getting sidetracked. They go on with this article to say, several recent accident investigations reveal a disturbing trend. Highly trained pilots who, faced with a stall, not only fail to correctly diagnose the problem, but take actions that make their predicaments far worse. And again, of course, they cite the Colgan Air flight crash, again in February 2009, flight 3407. Tired and distracted Captain Marvin Renslow and First Officer Rebecca Shaw failed to notice that the airspeed of their Bombardier-built Q400 turboprop had slowed significantly as they approached Buffalo's airport. Suddenly, the Q400 stick shaker warning system went off, alerting the pilots of an impending stall. But instead of increasing the throttle power and pointing the nose downward, Renslow pulled back on the yoke, turning a near stall into the real thing. He similarly outmuscled the plane's stick pusher feature, which is designed to force the plane's nose downward in a last-ditch effort to recover. So he overcame that system that's supposed to get you out of a stall. And, of course, the plane spiraled out of control, crashed, and killed 49 people on board and one person on the ground. Okay, so let's skip ahead here. As the operation of commercial jetliners becomes increasingly automated, most are equipped with systems that are perfectly capable of flying and landing the plane on their own, although pilots have the authority to hand-fly the plane when they deem it necessary. Now, I'd like to interject here. Almost every case in all of my experience has shown, even if we're using coupled approaches routinely, most pilots, when they get pretty close to the ground, a couple hundred feet above the ground, will turn off the autoflight system and actually manually land the airplane. Very few of us like letting the airplane actually do an auto land, unless we have to. You know, the maintenance might put a note in our flight plan that says, hey, the airplane hasn't had an auto land in a couple months and we need to have it logged so that we can keep it current and we can use it when we need it. But other than that, most of us will take control of the airplane, even those pilots who like to leave everything hooked up until the last minute. I'm not one of them. I like actually flying the airplane a lot farther out and a lot higher above the ground. But anyway, so the article kind of insinuates that, you know, autolands are kind of the rule and not the exception. But I would say that the autolands are the exception, not the rule. Anyway, I'll continue here. Some experts are concerned it's only becoming more difficult for pilots to jump in and take over during a mid-air emergency when their skills and experience are needed most. The problem you get into with automated systems is that very often people get out of the loop. Yes, very, very much so. And here it goes on to talk about what I was talking about. The reflex is to fix the problem by throwing more technology and automated systems at it. I've talked about this on an earlier Airline Pilot Guy show. Rockwell Collins, they manufacture instruments for airplanes. They made waves at this year's Paris Air Show when it talked about developing a panic button for commercial airplanes that would give confused and stricken pilots the option of flipping a switch and letting the computer fly the plane to safety. Not surprisingly, the concept drew ridicule from aviators, who are quick to point out that computers are hardly infallible, as anyone who has ever struggled with a crashed web browser knows. Quote, people say it's impossible to stall an Airbus, right? It has stall protection systems, and it won't allow you to exceed the maximum angle of attack where a stall would occur. Yeah, but that's not true. If there's ice on the wing, that whole detection system isn't accurate to begin with. I would be pretty hesitant to get on a plane with no pilot. I think that quote may have been taken a little out of context, because that sentence doesn't make sense. But anyway, so you get the drift here. The good news is that the industry, the safety industry, anyway, are taking a serious look at this whole problem that we're having. And again, I think that the answer here is not throwing more automation at it. It's teaching us how to fly the airplane. Those of us who are listening right now who are pilots, you may be a general aviation pilot, or you may be a commercial airline pilot, you might be a military pilot. We all know that, when's your first exposure to stalls and stall training and stall recovery? It's like one of the first flights that you do in your Cessna or your Piper or whatever kind of trainer you're using. You go out there and the instructor says, okay, we're going to practice stalls. And you think, oh, that doesn't sound like a lot of fun. But you go out there and do it. You know, you set the power to a certain setting, and usually something close to idle. And you pull the nose up, and then, you know, what happens? The airplane starts shuddering, and the nose drops. And how do we recover from it? We release the back pressure on the yoke. We put the nose down, add power, and you fly out of it. You get the air flowing over the wings. The problem is that most of us, that's about the only time we ever see a real aerodynamic stall. Yeah, we practice them in the simulators, but you know as well as I do that practicing stalls in the simulator aren't as realistic as actually doing them in an airplane. So anyway, they're taking a serious look. The safety people out there, the industry is taking a serious look on reintroducing that kind of an experience in our training, so that we know how to avoid an aerodynamic stall. And if we happen to get in one, we know how to recover from it. Okay, enough of that. This was sent in by somebody else, and I forgot to write down who it was. Thank you, whoever sent me this this article about pilot bathroom breaks, the latest air safety issue. This was from Time Magazine newsfeed. In just 3 seconds, a hijacker could take over a plane. How? By waiting for the pilot to go to the bathroom. Unlike recent airline passengers like actor Gerard Depardieu and U.S. ski team member Robert Witsa, I should have looked at this before I started reading it to you, pilots use the restroom when they have to relieve themselves. Duh. Seems simple enough, but the problem is that an innocent trip to the loo could spell disaster if a terrorist happens to be on board and waiting for the right opportunity. In a report this week, The Atlantic magazine noted that the FAA has been aware of this cockpit vulnerability for years. Although the cockpit doors are reinforced when they're open, there's nothing between a perpetrator and control of the airplane. This has prompted many in the airline industry to call for the implementation of installed physical secondary barriers, IPSBs. Yeah, great. Another acronym. which are retractable fence-like devices, to separate the cabin from the cockpit. Think of the IPSBs like baby gates that prevent children from falling downstairs. Instead, these barriers could potentially save hundreds of lives in the event of a plane hijacking. Let's see. FAA spokeswoman Allison Duquette told The Atlantic, "Right now, we don't see a need for the barriers." The report cites passenger complaints about cockpit doors being opened frequently or being left open for long periods of time during flight. Okay, so basically what they're saying is, you know, we've had, and those of you listening who are commercial airline pilots, you know what I mean. Right after September 11th, when we started flying again, I mean, it used to be the biggest concern we had was weather, right? At that point, I don't know about you, but I was hoping that wherever we were going, it was going to be good weather, because I knew that, you know, the terrorists hijacked those airplanes on a day when the weather was just absolutely beautiful. I don't think those terrorist pilots, suicide hijackers, could fly the airplane in instrument conditions. So for me, it was almost a security blanket when I went up in the airplane after September 11th and it was bad weather, because I knew that, hey, no terrorist is going to try to take over my airplane in this weather. But, you know, the concern that I had, and I'm sure many of you share this with me, was that somebody was going to try to take break into the cockpit and try to take control of the airplane. Immediately, we had certain procedures that went into effect as far as how we, you know, get out of the cockpit, go to the bathroom, and get back into the cockpit without anybody breaching that safety. And we have procedures at ACME, and I'm sure all the other airlines do, for, you know, quickly getting out of the, you know, quickly opening the cockpit door, going to use the bathroom, having flight attendants with meal carts and beverage carts blocking the way for anybody to get up to the bathroom just outside of the cockpit. And over time, remember, September 11th now, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary. As time goes on, we start forgetting about, you know, how dangerous it is to open up that cockpit door. I think we're probably getting a little complacent. And this article is just pointing out the fact that complacency is occurring. And a lot of people, a lot of passengers are concerned when they see the cockpit door open for extended periods of time. And that's why they're talking about these physical secondary barriers to be put into effect. I've also heard some ideas bandied about talk about making the cockpit kind of just its own place, and you know, like equipped with a bathroom and everything that we might need on a flight, so that once that cockpit door is closed, you know, we're sealed off and we'll never exit the cockpit. So I don't know how, you know, realistic a concept that is, but perhaps on some of the bigger airplanes like the super jumbos and everything, that might be something that we might see in the future. Anyway, thank you for whoever sent that to me. I appreciate that. And let's see, some other news. And this is good news. The FAA is reviving flight deck program for controllers. The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration is reintroducing a program that lets air traffic controllers get an up-close and personal experience in the cockpit of commercial airliners. Now, you know, you've heard me talk about jump seats. Jump seats are like an extra seat that's usually a foldable seat that folds out of the way when it's not in use, that airline pilots can use to commute to work or home from work, or FAA inspectors can use when they're doing in-flight inspection. And the jump seat can also be used for good use, for showing air traffic controllers what we do in the cockpit. And I think that's a great idea. We used to do this at ACME before September 11th. I remember several times having air traffic controllers on board with me. And again, I think it's a good idea in any industry, really, any job where you can see what other people do as far as what their jobs are entail. And it gives you a better appreciation of what's going on in your company or your industry. And I would also say that another good idea would be for pilots to be required, maybe once a year, to make a visit to an air traffic control facility, whether it be air route traffic control centers, you know, the high-altitude centers that are usually located away from an airport, and up into the actual control tower and watch what's happening up there with the tower controllers and the ground controllers and the handoffs and the coordination, et cetera, and see what they have to deal with from that, you know, from that side of the operation. I think that would be a great idea. Maybe I should, you know, occasionally I'll see communications from the company that say that the local tower people say that pilots are welcome anytime to come up for a tour. I might just have to do that. Maybe I'll take my recorder with me and record that. I think that would be interesting. Anyway, so good to see that the FAA program is being reinstituted, and I hope to see a bunch of you air traffic controllers on my jump seat. It'd be a lot of fun. Okay, let's see. How about some audio? Well, let's see. I'm going to go over here to some feedback. This was not audio feedback. It was sent to me at feedback@airlinepilotguy.com from Lisa Reinhardt. You know, you remember that a couple of episodes ago, I asked you to give me some suggestions for weather applications, whether it be for your desktop computer or your smartphone, and got a lot of responses from that, especially after I chided you for not sending me anything. So Lisa responded. Lisa Reinhardt, thank you. She said, have you tried the app Flight Plan Mobile? It was recommended to me. You can enter your destinations and get en route weather. It's free, too. And I downloaded it, and I'm still playing with it. Thank you, Lisa. That's a good idea. It has some nice weather features in there. And, let's see. Eric Roeder, he is a pilot for Eagle. And you remember me reading his feedback to you, and he said WOW. It looked like wow. And I surmised that that was an acronym for weight on wheels. And he says, apologies for the acronyms. WOW is weight on wheels at Eagle. And also he mentioned something about bad elf. And I thought that might be a typographical error that he made. But no, it's exactly what he meant. He said, as for the bad elf, it's a cool $99 attachment to your iPhone, which boosts the internal GPS receiver, which is lacking in flight. The unit plugs right into the charger port on the iPhone or iPad, I guess the 30-pin connector, and you get great reception on the ground or in flight, though it is best to have the unit find itself on the ground. When synced, the ForeFlight moving map works like a champ. I've used it in general aviation planes with great success. And then he goes on to wish me luck with my family issues, and so I appreciate that, Eric, and for clarifying that WOW is weight on wheels, and for telling us about the bad elf. Let's see, Brian Pottinger, I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correctly, Brian. He sent me some feedback, and let me just read it to you. This is very interesting stuff. Thanks so much for your podcast, Airline Pilot Guy. I've been listening for the last several weeks and have found the content to be interesting and informative. I really enjoy hearing about what's happening in aviation back home. I guess I should explain that I'm a pilot and that I fly for a Catholic mission in Papua, Indonesia. Associated Mission Aviation is the Catholic mission he's flying for. I currently fly a new Cessna Grand Caravan 208B with the Garmin G1000 glass cockpit. Over the last several podcasts, you had mentioned the time and place for automation, and I couldn't agree with you more. Flying over hundreds of miles of rainforest and then into mountainous areas of Papua, we know firsthand when it's appropriate to use the autopilot and when it's not. One thing that technically advanced aircraft have brought us is much better situational awareness. Today in my caravan, I have super accurate terrain mapping, TAWS, TCAS, which is the Traffic Collision Avoidance System, radar, storm scope, dual GPS, and an avionics suite, and a few years ago would have been only found in much larger transport category aircraft. Well, I can tell you this, Brian, that is more advanced than what I have in my commercial airliner. You got a lot of good stuff in there. Anyway, I'll continue with this feedback. However, because of that level of automation, it's important to also keep very sharp hand-flying skills. The normal airstrips we land on are unimproved dirt strips ranging from 400 to 600 meters and slopes up to 20%. from sea level to 9,000 feet elevation. During sim training back in the U.S. at a large, well-known training facility, I was glad to learn that the new G-1000 had to, or I was glad to learn all the new G-1000 had to offer, but was concerned that the instructors advocated flying the aircraft on autopilot from 400 feet above the ground after takeoff to decision height on landing. That's just not practical or safe where we fly. GPS direct is a good thing unless you have a mountain in between you and your destination that is higher than you are. And in a moment here, I'm going to play some of the feedback. Actually, he sent me a couple of YouTube links, and it has a there's one a video of him coming in for a landing at one of these trips, which is just incredible, and another one of the local people celebrating the arrival of the airplane, bringing in supplies. Let's see. Okay, I'm going to continue again with his feedback. On another note, I was interested to hear that Aviation Management Training Center is being considered for Indonesia. I'm 100% behind that. The single biggest downfall of aviation in Asia is lack of quality training. In recent history, we've had 9 controlled flight into terrain accidents just in Papua, all of them being 100% fatal. This happens when inadequate training is coupled with a shame culture and a majority religion that is extremely fatalistic. And he puts in quotes here, I mean in parentheses, if God wills that I crash, then I will crash. But if God wills I get to my destination, then I will even fly, or I will even if I fly below the minimum en route altitude or instrument flight rules off-routing. I hope that the training eventually gets down to the pilot level and that Indonesian pilots will have access to top-notch training, because what they are receiving right now is dangerous. Right now, we have pilots with as little as 100 to 200 hours filling the right seat of Boeing 737s carrying passengers. Okay, let me repeat that. In Indonesia and in parts of Asia, there are pilots with as little as 100 to 200 hours total time filling the right seat of a 737 carrying passengers. That, folks, is dangerous. I know several airline captains in the area, and I'm extremely concerned for their well-being as well as their passenger safety. It's not their fault, per se, but that of the airline that doesn't provide complete training and have reasonable experience requirements before handling or handing over such responsibility. Keep up the good work. I love listening to Airline Pilot Guy as I fly over hundreds of miles of jungle. If you're interested in learning about AMA, our website is www.ama-papua.com. That's ama-papua.com. The website's in Indonesian, but there is a bad English translation on the site. Sorry for the bad English, but I know you'll be able to understand it anyway. I also posted a couple of very short video clips to YouTube if you're interested to see where we fly. And I'll include those in the show notes, and I'll play a little bit of the audio from those here in just a second. Keep the shiny side up and the dirty side down. God bless. Brian Pottinger, Line Pilot Associated Mission Aviation. So let's listen to first the landing in Ungruk in Indonesia. And just to give you some narration here, there are mountains on either side of this airstrip, and the airstrip looks like it's going uphill at quite an amazing pitch. And so he's touched down, and he's really getting on the brakes, and then he follows this little road, continuing up this hill, and then turning around at the top. That's amazing, Brian. Really amazing conditions to land in. Beautiful. Oh, let's see. And then, of course, the people, looks like on that same little airstrip, celebrating the arrival. And again, you're just going to have to watch this in the links that I include in the show notes. Some interesting costumes they have in this celebration dance. It's especially the last guy. I'm not sure exactly what he is, what he's doing with that animal coming out of his britches there. But anyway, apparently he's very excited. All right, so thank you, Brian, for sending me that feedback. That was a lot of fun. Let's see, I received this from Renato Matos. Again, I'm probably mangling your name, Renato. But let me read this here. Hey, Captain, my name is Renato. I'm 30 years old, and I'm also an airline pilot. I was born in Brazil and grew up basically back and forth between Brazil and the U.S. I did all my training in the United States and a flight instructed for a while before moving down to Brazil and taking a job in corporate aviation. I did that for a few years, and I've been flying for TAM Airlines for the past several years. And let's see, I really enjoy listening to your podcast. It's always a great learning experience to find out what other fellow pilots think about current events in aviation. I just wanted to give you some feedback on your question about weather websites. I basically use aviationweather.gov and intellicast.com. And by the way, those are both really good sites that I refer to as well. However, there's one very interesting site called, and then he has the link here, and it's too long of a URL for me to say, but I'll include that in the show notes. But basically the site is called Meteo Total, and I guess that means total weather. He said, not sure if you're familiar with that site, but from what I've heard, it's a guy from Chile, not 100% sure about that, who's a meteorologist and posts various images on his website and keeps it updated. I've never gone into the site and found it to be outdated. It is especially useful if you're going on a transatlantic trip, as I usually do. As far as apps are concerned, since I'm a cheap sucker, most pilots are, by the way, I only have free apps, AeroWeather, good for TAFs and METARs, and Pilot's Toolbox, with many cool features such as friction coefficient decoders for Europe, among others. Thanks for the very enjoyable podcast. Keep up the good work. Take care, Renato. Thank you, Renato. And yeah, I use AeroWeather. I downloaded it quite some time ago and didn't really use it very much, but lately I've been using it quite often and find that a good one for terminal area forecasts and METARs. Yeah, I have not checked out Pilot's Toolbox. I'll have to do that and see what other cool features are in there. But getting back to that site, the Meteo Total, that the meteorologist in Chile, or maybe Madrid, he has one of the, a little badge on there that's talking about the local time in Madrid. But anyway, wherever he is, it's a great compilation of a lot of different satellite imagery and radar imagery from around the world. It's not the prettiest site in the world, but who cares, right? If it's useful, that's the important thing. And I was definitely interested in that. So you pilots out there, especially international pilots, check this site out. It'll be in the show notes. Thank you a lot for that feedback, Renato. Okay, let's see. This from Thailand. Dear Captain Jeff, I've been listening to your airline pilot guy podcast. It is very interesting. Let me introduce myself. My name is... Oh, I'm really going to mess this one up, so I apologize before my attempt here. Pachowut Tajumanying. How did I do there? I'm just going to call you Pat, if you don't mind. I'm a captain at Thai Airways International. I totally agree with you on the issue of pilot skill on manually flying. As an instructor, I always encourage my student pilots to fly manually during good weather. Let them observe and remember pitch attitude and thrust setting at various phases of flight. Who knows, maybe these kind of numbers may save their life. Keep up your good work. You have a fan on the other side of the world. Also wish you blue skies, unlimited visibility, and strong tailwind, and then he puts, during cruise. Thank you, Captain Pat. He's an A300 through 600 test pilot. I'm sorry, an A300-600 test pilot for Thai Airways International. Very cool. Thank you, thank you, Pat. You're right. These values, the pitch attitude and thrust settings, probably will save a lot of lives. And I'm glad you're out there teaching guys that. That's great. Let's see. So, yeah, continue to listen, Captain, and send me some more feedback. I appreciate that. Let's see. I got some feedback from my friend Michael Ryken, and he starts off by saying, "Good day, Captain. In response to your latest request for weather, my favorite weather site is Google, like this." And then he puts in a sample search, and I guess he just uses the Google search mechanism and puts in the weather for where he is, and where he is Perth, Australia. Yes, I know, it doesn't have any maps. I use it first thing in the morning to see if I should carry an umbrella that day or not. I recently moved from Minneapolis, Minnesota, USA, to Perth, Western Australia. I moved here during winter, which means that it rains sometimes. Quite the change from the winter I grew up with. Other than checking to see if I need to carry rain protection, I really have no use for the weather. It's what it is. I can only be prepared for it, umbrella, in the short term. I try not to worry about these 3 days hence, even if I have plans. Michael, you're starting to talk like a non-US person. I mean, it's very proper. So proper, I can't even read it. So let me try this again. I try not to worry about 3 days hence, even if I have plans. I guess weather-wise, I'm living in the moment. And he goes on to say, off topic, I've been a listener since you first started podcasting when I flew down here for the first time, the very long flight from Minneapolis to Perth via Los Angeles. I wore my Catholic Pilot t-shirt, which is still one of my favorites. Hey, thanks, Michael. Appreciate that. You know, I only made a few of those, so you're wearing one of a kind, actually. I very much enjoy your analysis and continue to listen to your shows, even if I don't offer a lot of feedback. Let's see. When I was jetting out about as a passenger in the United States prior to moving out here, I'd always hoped to hear you come over the intercom at the beginning of the flight, but sadly, no. There was no Captain Jeff. There was a Captain Jeff once, but it wasn't you. It wasn't your airline. Anyway, if you ever get down to Perth, then you're probably lost. Very funny. But if you get down here on purpose, there's a meal in it for you from the Rykens. With kind regards, Michael Ryken. Hey, thank you, Michael. Definitely. I don't know when I'll ever be down in Perth, Australia, but if I'm there, I'll definitely head over to your house and we'll share a meal. And again, I appreciate your feedback. Now, yeah, I guess, you know, a lot of people, you know, when I talk about weather sites, most people, that's really all they're concerned about. You know, what do I wear? Is it going to be hot, cold, rainy, sunny? And that really is what guides them. And that's the kind of information. That's the kind of thing that you're going to have in your smartphone, like the weather bug and that kind of thing. That's going to show you the sun or the clouds or rain or whatever. And that's really, really all most people need. But if you're a pilot flying through upper altitude weather systems, you want a little bit more information. Oh, I know this is going on quite long, but I'm just going to keep going here because I got a lot of feedback, and I appreciate your feedback, and so let's go. Hey, Captain Jeff, I just rediscovered one of my favorite weather sites. It's weather.unisys.com. This is from Chris from Connecticut. And he said, this is really a site for weather geeks. It has forecast models, aviation forecast models, GFS, upper level wind charts, radar, and all sorts of other goodies. They also recently came out with a free iPhone, iPad app called the Unisys Weather Enthusiast app. The only thing is, this site is very much intended for the weather enthusiast who understands reading weather forecast maps. I'll say that the GFSX and the ECWMF, I have no idea what those stand for, is not showing a positive outlook for the state of Connecticut for the hurricane right now. Obviously, he sent this before the hurricane hit, August 23rd, actually. We can hope that a high-pressure system shows up and pushes the storm out to sea, or that the storm spins further inland more quickly and deteriorates. Either way, the storm is several days out, and being that forecasting is barely accurate within 36 hours and the unpredictable nature of hurricanes, we have a long wait before we know what this thing is going to do. Speaking of which, how do airline operations handle these kind of major severe weather events? I mean, obviously flights get canceled and such, but are planes put into storage so they don't get damaged? Are there any other preparations aviators make for events like these? Thanks again for your podcast. I love hearing the ATC recordings and your breakdowns on them. I also really appreciate your analysis and insights on crashes and other such events. By the way, the Life on Fire site is malware-free now, so feel free to visit sometime. lifeonfire.org. Chris's wife, Tanya, and he have put out 3 episodes in as many weeks. And so, yeah, he is a fellow podcaster. He and his wife, Tanya, do a podcast called Life on Fire. So you can check them out on lifeonfire.org. And he is in the Hartford, Connecticut area. He put a P.S. here. I found a job in Hartford with normal 9-to-5 work hours so that maybe we'll have a better chance of getting together sometime in the future. So, Chris, we'll have to do that. In fact, I think sometime this month I have a layover in Hartford, so I'll give you a ring. And check out his podcast. I've been listening recently, Chris. It's great. It's very interesting to hear what you and Tanya are doing. And now that the Hurricane Irene has come and gone, and from what I can see in the news, looks like your area actually got hit, at least with the heavy rain and the flooding. So I hope that everything is okay for you guys there. So hang in there, and we'll pray for good things for you guys. And let's see. Dun, dun, dun. How about one more or so? This is from Luis Miguel Ponte. And again, probably mispronouncing that. Hi, Captain Jeff. I'm Luis from Portugal, and I've just finished listening to your latest Airline Pilot Guy podcast, number 10. First of all, I'd like to thank you for your podcast. It's been very interesting to hear about your take on some aviation news and your personal experiences as an airline pilot, specifically about the Air France 447 accident. I'm astonished by the behavior of the stall warning in that aircraft. Clearly, it must have added to the confusion of the pilots. Even in hindsight, when listening to your initial description of what happened, it was pretty confused and wondering what was going on there. So what's your take on that? I know you've talked about it in the show already, but I would like to know, how do you think the system should work? Should the warning sound even when the airspeed data is deemed to be erroneous? I really don't know what the best solution is. Also, what is the behavior of such warning in the aircraft you fly? I don't know if you think this might be a bit too technical for your talk, for you to talk about on the show, but perhaps you can reply to me via email. No, I'll talk about it on the show here, Luis. One last note, a little bit about myself. I am not into any part of the aviation industry, just one of your fellow aviation lovers. I always loved airplanes and have been flying Microsoft Flight Simulator as a hobby for about 10 years now. Perhaps one day I'll take some flying lessons and become a pilot myself. Oh, by the way, about Microsoft Flight Simulator, I'm not sure if you've ever tried the program or if you know anyone that has some experience with it. If you do, how realistic do you think it is? I understand it might not be the best representation possible of the flying characteristics of an aircraft, but in my mind, bear in mind that I've never flown an airplane in the real world, it appears to give a basic idea of how a plane flies. We flight simmers all have to believe that, given favorable conditions, we would be able to fly a real plane with our simulator background. Of course, not a substitute for any real pilot training, just a nice background to come from. Also, systems and instruments are very realistically represented in some of the top aircraft add-ons available. I was just curious if you've ever heard about or tried some of these products and what is your take on them. Once again, thank you for your show. Keep it up. Luis Ponte, or Ponte, from Portugal. No, I've never used the flight simulator program, either the Microsoft Flight Simulator or any of the competitors. But I have heard that they are very realistic, and I agree. I think that if it was one of those situations where the airplane, you know, the pilots are dead or they're incapacitated, and you know, if it was up to somebody flying the airplane that hasn't had any experience at all but does have flight simulator experience, I think that yeah, chances would be better than somebody that had never ever, you know, tried one of those flight simulators. But maybe a real pilot, or not, I shouldn't say a real pilot, a pilot out there who has experience flying airplanes and experience doing the flight simulators can chime in, send me some feedback. Let me know. Maybe you can answer, Luis, on that point. Let's see, as far as what you asked earlier about, you know, what I think the behavior should be in an airplane as far as the stall warning system being inhibited, etc., I'm not really sure. I think that they're going to have to do a lot of tests on this and a lot of simulations to see what the best solution is for this situation. I think that stall warning system being inhibited did contribute to the crash and probably should have been sounding the whole time. Let's see. And how is it in, you asked about the warning in the aircraft iFly. Yeah, as far as I know, the aircraft iFly, once the stall warning system is activated, it continues to activate until you do something to solve the situation. I don't think it's inhibited in any way, unless you inhibit it yourself. So, in most traditional airliners have a stick shaker, which calculated on the angle of attack, a system will determine that you're approaching a stall and will start shaking, vibrating the control column to get your attention so you can do something before something bad happens. And then, of course, after that, a stick pusher goes into effect, which actually manually pushes the control yoke forward to get the nose down and recover from a stall. So that's the way it works on the airplanes that I've flown so far, anyway. Let's see. I know this is a long show. Oh, by the way, thanks again, Luis, for your feedback. And again, anybody out there with experience with Microsoft Flight Simulator or one of the others, send me some feedback, and maybe we can answer that question. I know I have some more audio feedback, and gosh, if you don't mind me continuing here with this very long podcast, you know, it's been a few weeks, so you can always hit pause and go back and continue listening here. So I'm going to play this from Mike Rogers from Bloomington, Illinois.
Hi, this is Mike Rogers, and I have really been enjoying your podcast. I find them to be very insightful, and I think you have the perfect radio voice. I was absolutely entranced with your description of Air France 447 and amazed that those pilots were in a situation where it seemed that all the automation was seemingly conspiring against them. I mean, you had the stall horn that was turning off when the stall got worse, and you had the air speeds that vanished when they got too slow. I wonder if the pilots knew about this behavior and trained for it. To me, the key unanswered question was about the altimeter. I presumed the altimeter was also not functioning. If it was, obviously they could see that they were dropping like a brick and would know that they would have to lower the nose. It also seems to me that if they had just had a working handheld GPS, they might have had better luck. Anyways, to me, this whole situation seems very, very, very mysterious. Regarding your request for aviation weather sites, my favorite is ads.aviationweather.gov, that's ADDS.
And I had to stop the playback there. Sorry about that, Mike. For some reason, we got a bunch of interference and static and some nasty stuff at the end of your recording. And so what he was recommending was the ADDS.aviationweather.gov, which I refer to every day, by the way. I usually look at their prog charts, but a lot of great stuff in there, including some Java tools, which are pretty cool. And again, that's aviationweather.gov, I believe. And then he also mentioned something about ForeFlight. That seems to be an app that a lot of people are referring to. So that's one that everybody should check out as well. Thanks again, Mike, for your feedback. And the stall warning system again. Here we're talking about this again and the airspeed. Yeah, the airspeed was inhibited because, again, the autoflight system, the computers decided that it was invalid. So I'm not even going to show you any airspeed. But the vertical velocity indicator indeed was working. And if it's like any of the vertical velocity indicators that I've ever seen, it basically pegs out at plus or minus 6,000 feet per minute. So in this case, I'm sure it was indicating at least 6,000 feet per minute descent. In actuality, for most of their drop from 38,000 feet, it was about 10 to 11,000 feet per minute. And again, that was one of those factors that the investigators cited, that the fact that they didn't have airspeed indication, the fact that the stall warning system kept going on and off, and then the incredible rate of descent and very, very loud noise kind of gave them the sensation that they were going really, really fast forward. They thought they were overspeeding the airplane. That's why they were kept pulling back on the control stick to try to climb the airplane to decrease the speed. But there was so much noise in that cockpit, they thought that they were just rushing forward through the air at a very high rate of speed. When in fact, the noise, the sound that they heard was the airplane dropping like a rock, so that the noise was not going, or the airflow was not going from the front to the back. It was going from the bottom up. And that was very confusing for that crew. Excuse me. So thanks for your feedback, Mike. Continue to listen and send me some more. And speaking of sending me more, well, actually, Ken's never sent me feedback, but let me play this from Ken Stringer.
Hey, Captain Jeff. My name is Ken Stringer. I just discovered your podcast. I enjoy the shows quite a bit. I've listened to the first one and the most recent one. I just got done with number 3. I enjoyed the insert with that you read from Captain from Len Morgan in his book. I was a big fan of his book as well growing up. Keep up the good work. I'm also an Atlanta-based pilot. I fly right seat on the RJ at ASA, and I look forward to more shows. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Great to have you aboard, Ken, and thanks for your feedback. And a fellow aviator flying out of the world's busiest airport, Atlanta Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport. Yeah. Thanks for listening, and hope you continue to send feedback and enjoy the shows. Well, you know what? I'm going to look at my notes here one last time, make sure I haven't forgotten anything. If you sent me feedback and I didn't read it, I apologize. I tried to get everybody's feedback in the show today, and if I missed some, you know what? There is one piece of feedback I do absolutely need to play before we go, because this has a bearing on probably my next show. As you know, right now I'm recording this on Wednesday, the 31st of August. Tomorrow is September 1st, which means that we're coming up very rapidly on the 10th anniversary of that tragic event that changed the lives of many people forever, and it changed the airline industry. And that, of course, is the terrorist attacks on September 11th of 2001. So we're coming up on that 10th anniversary. And let me play this bit of feedback from Jeff.
Hello, Captain Jeff. This is First Officer Jeff. I've sent you feedback a long time ago. You once asked for pilots' inputs on those who had been flying on 9/11. And I sent you a letter that I send out every year, and you very nicely read it over the air about a year and a half ago. And with 9/11 quickly approaching the 10th anniversary, I'm kind of hoping that maybe you'll do that again. Maybe you'll have some more letters from other pilots and their experiences of what happened. Not so much to focus on the pilots, but to focus on the fact that something we should never forget. I've been an avid listener since I got my iPhone almost 2 years ago. It's a wonderful thing to be able to listen to a fellow aviator, even if you fly for a competitor. It's neat to hear your take on things. It just kind of changes some of the things that I see going on and the way I react to things and different interpretations of things. You asked about weather applications. Weather channel is one that I use. I use AccuWeather. They're more for just the day-to-day weather when I'm at home or when I'm on a layover. It's nice because they work internationally, which is how I fly. In fact, right now I'm in Paris, France. I just listened to your latest number 10, and I got them in order 9 and 10. I didn't see the first 10, I guess. And I downloaded my radar. I was shocked because it actually shows the radar in France, which is something that's usually very hard to get. An app that my company offers to us is a website called WSI.com. I believe it's a paid subscription that our company gets for us. It's neat because it shows everything from winds aloft to surface analysis to METARs and VOLMETs, and it shows the thunderstorms. It's got NEXRAD. It's got satellite IR, and it has the entire world. So no matter where I'm flying, be it the Caribbean, out over the North Atlantic, or in the United States, I can see the current weather, forecast weather, and how things are progressing, you know, with the fronts everything we as pilots, especially commercial pilots, need to know for the distances that we travel. And I don't know if ACME has something like that. I think I saw something that in the iPad you guys are getting, they've downloaded some kind of weather app for you, but I don't know if you've had access to that or not. Some other feedback, having flown the Super 80, not the MD-90, just the MD-80, 82s and 83s specifically, I can testify to the metal brakes and their chatter. Hated it. There was no way to smoothly stop that airplane. I would like to have gotten to fly with the carbon brakes, and the flying tail would have been kind of nice too versus the tabs. I did not like the tabs and the spoilers on that airplane. I'm a more conventional ailerons and rudder and elevator kind of guy, I guess. Keep up the good work. I appreciate all your the work you do. You've actually sent me to some other great podcasts via the Catholic Pilot and now the Airline Pilot Guy that I've gotten to listen to. And hope to hear from you soon. I hope to maybe hear my letter again and possibly some other pilots' letters. Take care and God bless. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jeff. That's a great idea. All you right now listening, especially not just pilots, but especially the pilots, if you were flying 10 years ago on September 11th, I'd like to hear your experience. And I'm going to read Jeff's letter again that he sent me and I read about a year and a half ago. I'm going to read that again on the next show. I'm going to talk about, you know, my experience during September 11th. And if you were flying at that time, it would be interesting to hear what happened with you. And you can either send that to feedback@airlinepilotguy.com, or better yet, do like as Jeff did. You know, he took his iPhone and hit the voice memo app or some kind of recording app and recorded some feedback and just emailed it to me. That's great. Thanks, Jeff. That sounded great. Or you can call the feedback number, area code 304-99-PILOT, 304-997-4568. Again, it'd be great to hear your stories about where you were and what you felt and what you did on September 11th. And as far as the ACME meteorology app, what they were talking about with the tablet use, is probably just some kind of an application that's very similar to what we have available to us when we use the ACME internet or intranet. ACME Meteorology has a whole... We actually have meteorologists on staff at ACME that provide a lot of information for us, and we'll have access to that via the tablet, supposedly. So that's what... that was all about. And let's see, what else did you mention there? Gosh, I don't know. So many things you talked about, and I should have jotted it down, and I didn't. So if I missed something, let me know. But as always, I really appreciate your feedback, Jeff. And again, that was a great idea for September 11th coming up here very soon. So send me your stories, people, and we'll talk about it on the next show. So until next time, I hope that you have a great week and great flights out there. Fly safely, and wishing you blue skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds, unless you're landing. Take care, and God bless.
It's terrible!
Horrendous!
I'm offended!
I'm appalled!
So what are we gonna do?
Oh, what else? Email it to everybody we know!
Good idea.
SQPN, leading the way in Catholic new media.